depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of July 31st, 2016. That's right. We're more than halfway through the year, and boy, has it been a great year so far. Lots of excitement, lots of developments, and there's no indication at all that the second half of the year is going to slow down at all. Of course, we at Information Week will be here bringing it all to you, and to help me today, I have my esteemed colleague, Charlie Babcock, who is a editor at large for Information Week. Charlie, welcome to Information Week Live.
Well, thank you, Kurt. I've been away for a few weeks. It's good to be back.
Well, you know, I was going to ask, people occasionally will ask me what different editorial titles mean. As an editor at large, do you roam the earth looking for stories? How does that work?
Well, the analogy I use, Kurt, is the Dragnet one. The criminal was always at large. The police didn't know where he was or what he was doing. And that's kind of my relationship with my editors.
Always on the lam, and we like it that way. That's I think that's a good way to go.
It's working for me. I hope that I'm working for them as well.
Oh, no question, no question at all. Well, I wanted to dive in because, well, something that actually hasn't happened quite yet, but happens in just a few hours, and it's going to be big news for, we'll call it, the next 3 weeks. The 2016 Olympic Games will start in Rio de Janeiro. It's going to have an impact not only on the athletes and those watching, but on a lot of IT groups. What do you know about what the IT professionals believe is going to be happening because of the Rio Olympics?
Well, a couple different firms have tried to survey IT managers on that issue. They happen to be in either networking monitoring, network acceleration, or network security, or possibly all three. They've both come back with a report that says network managers inside companies anticipate there will be heavy viewing of the Olympics and that there will be more devices from which they'll be able to tune into events with. Smartphones are a leading example, but tablets and certainly the desktop PCs, the desktop and laptops remain the primary instrument for your sneak peek at the Olympics while at work. And they think this is going to lead to surges in network traffic inside the company, possibly interfering with other revenue-generating traffic. So they're going to keep an eye on it. Surprisingly, none of the companies talked to seem to have issued warnings or bans or prohibitions on employees watching the Olympics. There's a kind of a sigh and a sense of inevitability followed by some watchful monitoring.
Well, now this sounds a lot like the same sort of thing that we talk about every March when the NCAA basketball tournament is played, because the 65 teams that start out there play games that are not just played in the evening when people are off, but through the afternoon. So do you think that the experience of those, you know, the March Madness episodes are going to have anything to tell the IT managers about how they can best adapt their networks to the strain of the Olympics?
They're a good precursor. That's not a bad analogy, but you have to consider that those audiences tend to reflect some passionate alumni following of their school teams or just a more, it's a more limited crowd than the Olympics potentially could command. Everyone's got a favorite event at the Olympics. They don't all occur on the same day, but it's not like you're following a school or a playoff series leading toward a big final game. It's a series of big final games that will each attract a crowd, some of them overlapping, and not everyone is a basketball fan and participates in March Madness. The number of people who are interested in Olympic events, however, is much higher, as there are a few people who turn a cold shoulder to them, but not many. And I like the track and field myself.
Well, it's interesting. I'm a big track and field fan, and I watched the U.S. Olympic trials, the track and field trials that took place mostly from Oregon. But I've been fascinated looking at my own viewing habits, because I have to admit that I have been watching some of the preliminaries for events that I normally wouldn't swear to you were real events. Things like I caught myself watching the preliminaries to the men's synchronized diving. And who knew that synchronized diving was a real event? So I do think I'm going to be watching a lot of the Olympics. Now, fortunately, I work from a home office, so it's not going to be big blow to the enterprise network, but I do think that there are a lot of people in office buildings around the country that are going to be sneaking looks and keeping tablets and smartphones open and streaming on their desks. Now I've got to ask, you mentioned track and field. What kind of events do you really look forward to in the Summer Olympics?
Oh, I need to translate to meters, but I like the equivalent of the mile event. What is that?
Mile
1600 meters.
Yep, that's about right.
And 400 meters is roughly a quarter mile, and then the 10,000, 15,000 long distance running events I find fascinating, because the runners are so good, they actually have a strategy for how to execute the race. My only execution plan was to reach the finish line, still standing.
Yeah, my very first 5K race, someone asked me what my target time was, and I told them my target time was didn't die on course. So far, I have successfully matched that personal record in all of my 5Ks. I also like those. And I have to tell you, I've been fascinated by the steeplechase lately. The steeplechase is one of those races that, there's not the weekend steeplechase that exists in most towns. Most cities, you can find a 5K, a 10K, half marathon, marathon, things like that going on any given weekend. But the steeplechase is not one of those. So I'm looking forward to that, and I've also got to give a shout-out to another really exciting event, archery, because the U.S. Olympic archery trials took place about 5 miles west of my house. There's a big archery park that's been set up out here, and so they have big archery competitions, and it was fascinating watching all of the Olympic archers come to town.
That's interesting. I would like archery too, but really, Kurt, isn't this show about technology?
Well, I suppose it is, and I appreciate you bringing me back down to the technology, helping me with intelligence. And speaking of intelligence, one of our colleagues wrote a piece on AI. And not so much a change in AI technology, but a suggested change in AI nomenclature. What was Tom's article about in this proposed shift in labeling?
I think he felt that AI had gotten a bad name, that expectations initially were built up too high for artificial intelligence, and that turned out not to be a good name to begin with. People equated computer intelligence with human intelligence, and it was never such a thing, and never realized the sort of false expectations set for it. And the suggestion to call it augmented intelligence is actually that let AI stand for augmented intelligence is a very good one. It is a better descriptor and more closely matches what the computer and computer software can do alongside human intelligence, and could possibly catch on as a replacement for the stained name of AI.
Well, let me ask you about this. In the vision world, we've had artificial reality and augmented reality, which are two very different things. You've been following artificial intelligence for a long time. You and I both have been around long enough to have written any number of stories on the topic. Do you think that by shifting the name to augmented intelligence, it might end up changing the focus of some of the research to be assistive research rather than replacement research when it comes to the relationship between the program and the people who build it?
Well, I think anyone who was researching replacing human intelligence was probably going down a dead-end path anyway. All of the research that I know about looks an awful lot like how to augment human intelligence, how to supplement it, how to make use of the power of the computer to get us to insights and reasonings that we can't hold enough data in our brain to get to on our own. The thing that the computer excels at is really rather different than what the human brain excels at. And the day may come when the two things are perhaps regarded as equal, but right now I see the algorithms and the thinking and programming that's gone into IBM's Watson shows a great deal of human intelligence designed for use by a machine, given algorithms to which it can apply to vast amounts of data and content. So I think it's kind of giving AI a new chance, a new face, a chance to be reconsidered for what it actually is, as opposed to what some people sort of expected it to be.
I like this idea, because what I would really like is for my system to be better at helping me. If, for example, when I'm working on an article, my system could notice what I'm working on and pull up a pane that says, hey, you might want to research some of these things. That would be really useful. I don't want it to write the article for me, but if it could assist me, I think that would be superb. And I think you're right. That's one of those areas where that kind of assistance could really broaden the application for a lot of people. And frankly, I think take some of the fear away. It would be interesting to know if Elon Musk could even get on board with that kind of augmented intelligence, as opposed to being rather afraid of artificial intelligence.
I imagine he would agree with the goals of that renaming. I would suggest in Tesla that they call their feature augmented pilot instead of autopilot.
You know, it's interesting, because I had a conversation way back in January. I attended the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, as they now call it, without any expansion. And I had a chance to sit down with a senior Ford engineer at their autonomous driving car, the test bed, or in mm-hmm. Car language, the test mule that they had brought to the show floor there at CES. And he and I spent some time talking about the difference, the radical difference from an engineering standpoint between the assistive technology that we're becoming accustomed to, you know, all the things that tell us if we're wandering out of our lane or if we're about to hit something, the cameras that show us where we're backing up, all of those things, versus a truly autonomous vehicle. And I was surprised because I know a lot of people who have said, why can't they just take all of the technology that they're using for the driving assistance and glue it together to make an autonomous vehicle? And he was very clear that in working towards assistance rather than autonomy, there are vast differences, not just in what is done, but in the way things are done. And I really found that fascinating. And I think that you're right. It really could lead to some changes in the way research into AI is done if the goal is augmentation rather than being a separate autonomous intelligence.
Yes, that sounds good. I'm not sure I look forward to the day when autopilot or some other kind of autonomous system is driving my car for me. I'm not quite ready to yield total control to automated systems. And I think possibly it could work with airplanes where the avenues in the sky are much bigger and much less populated than our, say, Bay Area highways. But we still have a long ways to go on this stuff. The Tesla incident where a driver was killed by driving under a 18-wheeler in his path. The final report is not in on that, but possibly too much faith in the autopilot system, not enough attention on the road.
You know, I think that that's one of those places where the early adopters tend to have problems placing too much faith in any given technology. And as we saw in that Tesla crash, with sometimes tragic results. Well, I'd like to get away from tragedy a little bit. We risk going off and making people sad on a Friday afternoon. So I want to get back to a happier topic, and this is one that you wrote about this week. Some new container management. And, you know, containers are one of those technologies that's in the background, but it seems like every time I turn around, there's some real progress being made. So is Mesosphere, is it real progress, or is it a bit of incremental advance?
Well, I would call it more real progress in the sense that we have a system now that can not only build containers in a uniform way and kind of guide their network movement, allow them to be highly mobile over a network and between data centers and that kind of thing. We're getting into more of deployment issues where the container not only has to be built, but it has to go out and work in a real production environment. And that means connecting to other things. The problem nowadays is scale. The container is running on a cluster, and it may wish to do things with another cluster or another system on the same cluster. This may be thousands of machines, hundreds of machines, tens of thousands of machines. it becomes a very large scheduling task, and Mesosphere has figured out how to build a cluster management system that can yield some control over scheduling to a secondary or subsystem. It doesn't sound like much, but if you think about the conflicts inherent in deploying and managing containers, and then deploying and managing workloads in those containers to a secondary system and deciding all of its priorities, across 10,000 servers, the complexity becomes overwhelming, whereas Mesosphere, thanks to the open source project, had a built-in piece of plumbing that said, we'll do this and this, and we'll yield to Hadoop or MapReduce or some other cluster system the scheduling of the workloads that it's working with. We will receive information. We'll receive the metadata on those assignments. We'll know what's going on. We can plan our own work accordingly, but we're not going to try to dictate where every workload goes, what its priority is, when it's or when it is commanding too many resources off the cluster. So I thought that was interesting, kind of a big step forward toward production systems at scale. Both Kubernetes and Docker are working on the same problem, but I'm interested that Mesosphere may have thought this through from the beginning and might have an edge at this point.
You know, when I hear you talk about this, one of the things that I find truly interesting is that containers seem to be in an area where open source has not just the upper hand, but the overwhelming upper hand against any of the proprietary systems. Is that just because of what I'm reading, or is it your sense that open source really has won the day in the container field so far?
Well, it has won the day in the sense that it started out as an open source project. Google made its internal container management system an open source project in Kubernetes. Docker started out and tried to establish itself when it realized it had a viable technology with its container building format and process and success at packaging up code for movement around the data center or between data centers. So all of that is open source, but I think on top of the open source, Docker, Mesosphere, CoreOS have added some of their own systems with some proprietary code to enhance what they've got and charge for it. There is still a very good core systems available as open source, but we kind of have a bit of a mixed picture as to, in the long run, what people will end up using in production systems will be something that they'll want to pay for, at least in the sense that it's a commercially supported system from a vendor with a commercial revenue stream. And it's not just open source that they're tinkering with themselves.
Okay, so you said something in your last answer that I think it's important to get to. You talked about, you know, the potential difference between what a company's production group would use for their sandboxing, for their trials, and then what they might use for their production machines. When it comes to containers, are we still seeing a lot of companies that are in that sandboxing and trial phase, or from what you're hearing, have these well and truly moved out into production and now it's just the sort of normal evolution of a commercial marketplace?
I would try not to answer that question definitively because I don't know the answer. But yes, people are doing a lot of container experimentation, experimental deployment in the sandbox, in sandbox systems, or in limited experimental systems. And then again, if they are a company like Google, like Zynga, or Microsoft even, they are putting containers into production to make sure they understand how that's going to work and that they can build large-scale systems with them. Later this year, Microsoft will have container support for Docker in its latest release of Windows Server. They've done a lot of work on containers so that their customer base can move into them in somewhat the same fashion that the Linux community has. But the Linux people led on containers and figured out how to make them so mobile and portable and movable. So we're headed, no doubt, toward smaller slices of applications inside containers that can be run in different places but still work together, or can be run in the same data center but across a large cluster of servers. And that'll make for a microservice-oriented application and allow us to tinker with parts of the application and update it without interfering with its operations elsewhere. But still a lot of work to be done, greater complexity involved, and we still don't know everything about how we're going to manage thousands or tens of thousands of containers loose in the data center.
Well, it sounds like we're going to have plenty to continue to write about for a good long time. So I'll call that a very good thing, since I do enjoy being employed as a journalist in the tech industry.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's going to be the progress is been quite rapid, more so with containers than with virtual machines. And containers have remained more in the public realm and open source code realm, as you suggested, than virtual machines did. So lots of people working on the problems, lots of different ideas, several different systems kind of competing head-to-head to do some of the same things, all of which is good and fun to write about.
Well, speaking of writing about, we've come to that part of the show where it's time to look forward a little bit. So I know that you tend to keep your eye on a bunch of different things at once. What sorts of things should we be expecting from you in the coming week?
Well, I think, again, the idea of production deployment should hold sway, and we should take a look at the Internet of Things. We have GE with Predix out there and promise of data centers to host Predix services. I spoke with Tom Siebel, formerly or the founder of Siebel Systems, purchased by Oracle in 2006, I believe. Tom went on to do other things, and about 2009, 2010, he started a company called C3. Initially called C3 Energy because it was focused on maximizing your ability to get good energy out of oil and gas and also out of the electrical generating system, but to do it in a more environmentally responsible way. And C3 has evolved into C3 IoT, or Internet of Things. His company has both a set of applications for the utility industry, and they have a platform for building applications initially for the utility industry, but they think it's good for all industries. So I'm going to try to write about that. Tom has been up to interesting things. He seems to be a man not content to rest on his wealth or his laurels.
Well, sounds like a fascinating interview. We're going to look forward to that. And I know that you let readers know when your articles are up by putting out the word on the Tweety Pipes and other social media. How can people follow you out there in Twitter land?
I think the best way, at Babcock CW.
Well, we will certainly be doing that. Charlie, thanks so much for being with me today.
Good to talk with you, Kurt.
As for me, I've got an article coming up on DevOps pitfalls to avoid. To be honest, it's kind of fun sometimes looking at different ways that disasters can happen and talking about how they can be avoided. I've also got some interviews that I've done that I think are going to come up into some interesting articles because they're interesting people. One is with someone who was a professional musician, transitioned into being a software developer and ultimately owner of a dev group, talking about the similarities between music and software development. Also talking with folks about the Internet of Agricultural Things and the way that some people are using no-code and low-code programming frameworks to write enterprise applications. Also have an interesting piece coming up on the Bergen County, New Jersey Sheriff's Office and how they have built a hyper-converged infrastructure for their VDI platform, their virtual desktops. Interesting stuff, lots of lessons there for all kinds of IT professionals. We certainly hope that you will join us for all of those articles. Speaking of joining us, next week we begin a new series of radio shows here at Information Week. We're going to be doing shows in conjunction with our corporate partners over at Interop, the trade show that happens every spring in Las Vegas. We've been doing a lot of articles based on some of the topics that they cover in their conference, and we're going to restart Interop Radio. Those of you who have been listening a long time know that I have done Interop Radio in the past. Well, this time it's not just me. The entire editorial team from Information Week is getting involved, and I think it's going to make for some really great radio shows. So look for that and all of our articles there at informationweek.com. Look for me on Twitter at KG4GWA, where we'll try to let you know all of this as it's happening. Well, thank you so much for spending half an hour with us today. If you have done this on Friday when we're live, thank you. And we would love to have your voice in the online conversation that accompanies this show. If you're listening to us on a streaming version, thank you so much. We appreciate that. But think about coming and joining us in the live version on Friday afternoon. Again, we have a great conversation. Would love to have your voice in that discussion. Well, for Charlie Babcock and everyone here at Information Week, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for listening. See you next week.